ください。Maybe we should all chip in and buy him one.
Well, you know, we should send a letter at least to LGG. All this advertising must be worth something to them. Yeah, what can I do you for?
Yeah, I hear all this discussion about tuners. Lorraine, if you could explain, I never really understood exactly how a tuner works.
Okay, an antenna tuner is just a glorified impedance matching circuit. By adjusting variable capacitors and inductors, you take a impedance, say, of 100 ohms, which would present as a 2-to-1 viswa and a bit of a mismatch, and you can change the impedance to 50 ohms, where your resultant viswa is 1-to-1.
Sounds French.
I'm sorry. I actually never learned French. I learned Spanish, but not very well. But it's just a matter of standing wave ratio. One of the ways to explain or describe it is the mismatch from the standard 50-ohm impedance that you want with transmitters and coaxial cables. We usually use 50-ohm impedance coaxial cables, and so you want the antenna feed point to be perceived as 50 ohm, even if it isn't. So if it's producing 100 ohms or 200 ohms, you're having a SWR mismatch, and you're going to have reflections, and you're going to have problems transferring your energy from your transmission line and your transmitter to your antenna. So you somehow have to finagle the impedance. The way that we modify the impedance is with impedance transforming circuits. So, like I said, there are T circuits and L circuits and pi circuits, different configurations of where you put the capacitors and where you put the inductors, and both of them are variable, and that's why the knobs for manual antenna tuners are, you know, there's at least two for the capacitor and for the inductor. And adjusting the values for those variable inductances and capacitances, you're able to take something that isn't 50 ohms impedance and transform it into something that is 50 ohm impedances. Hope that's less French.
No, that's very well spoken, well said. No, what you said about viswa, that's why I said it sounds French.
I do that out of respect for good old Dick K2RW. I don't think he ever said SWR. He always called it viswa.
Said it so eloquently.
Sounds like vichyssoise.
Well, yeah, I don't know. It sounds a little bit odd. So, you know, I mean, I kind of default into SWR because people don't have viswa meters. They have SWR meters. So I assume the average guy who's listening to this is probably more likely to recognize an SWR than a viswa. Probably not. It's just going through more algorithmic steps to get to the magic number that it's looking for. I guess it doesn't have a functional memory, because usually if it kind of stores the settings in memory, it should go snap to it rather than go through the algorithm. But I don't see where it's a particular problem. It's just a longer path, you know, because it goes through different legs of an algorithm depending upon what antenna and what frequencies you're trying to match.
Comment.
Yes, Brian?
For example, if I tune to a particular frequency and I tune up and I get, let's say, a 1.2, and then I retune, do it again, and then it comes down to a 1.1 or sometimes a 1.0. So the algorithm isn't exact. It's like, figure like ballpark.
Well, yeah, I think it's generally, you know, they program a little bit of quirkiness to program algorithms like that. So, yeah, it's not a direct trip. It doesn't have any kind of impedance sensing circuits. It just can read what the visual is, and it's trying to get to a relative low setting, but not necessarily a one-to-one. And, you know, it'll try in big steps or little steps depending upon how people have written its algorithms.
2 MCP.
Yeah, Chris?
Since we're advertising for LDG, the LDG does have some settings for how much hunting you want it to do, how I forgot the word they use, how exact perfect match you want to find, but there's a setting for that. And the default is pretty good. You can make it lower. I've made mine pretty low, but it's been a long time since I looked at that. But it does have that setting, and it will memorize it on the station. So that gentleman said it takes a long time. That should only happen once on that frequency. Change frequencies, tune up somewhere else, and then go back to that exact frequency and tune again. It should be instantaneous.
Yeah, I would suspect that to be the case. Maybe there's some internal setting where you can turn the memories off.
I believe you can turn their memories off. I don't remember reading that in the manual.
Okay, it's been a long time since I played with my LDG. I know for my Palstar, you can actually reset the memories. So I wouldn't be terribly surprised if that would be the case for LDG as well.
Yes, there's absolutely a reset to clear it all and start over. But I don't think you can turn it off or bypass it so it doesn't save them.
Comment.
Okay. Yeah, Brian, you want to say something?
On the LDG 100, you cannot go ahead and reset the latching relays. Like, for example, you just had it delivered and you're already tuning up and building up that matrix of different frequencies that it's latching. Once it's latched, you know, that's it. If you fill up the memories, they'll go ahead and roll over, you know, like a first in, first out sort of thing.
Comment.
Yeah, what would you like to comment?
Okay, the latching relays, they have nothing to do with it. The latching relays are so that they won't continue to draw current once you've got the thing set up correctly. But, let's say you're on 40 meters, you go to 80. Now it goes to the memory, and if you've been to 80 before at the particular frequency, it goes to the memory, and it knows which relays need to be energized or latched on, let's call it on, and which need to be off. And it quickly sets them. If it doesn't, and this is true of any auto tuner, it has to search. If it hasn't been to that memory before, it has to search. And the idea of latching is, once again, once it's set up in the memory, you don't want to keep drawing current from the relays. You want to send a current to the relay once to tell it to latch on, or send it once to tell it to latch off. So it doesn't remember the frequency because of the latching. It remembers the frequency because of memory, and the frequency tells the relay whether it should be latched on or latched off. AF2B.
Yes, I think that's a very good explanation. I agree.
Well, I agree as well. Yeah, latching is not a function of the memory. Latching is just the mechanical nature of once you've energized the relay, it's capable of kind of locking into that position even when you're unpowered.
So here's the whole thing. With any of these auto tuners, once you fill up all the memory locations, basically it will rewrite over.
Yeah, it rolls over the memories. That's a very common way of, you know, I mean, security cameras work that way. Almost everything with limited memory works that way.
In addition, when you go to the same memorized frequency, you go to it again, it switches all the latches for that frequency, and it does do another check, and it sometimes can adjust it because your antenna can change, so it does check it.
Yeah, again, it kind of depends on the programming, depends on the tolerances. If it's set for real loosey-goosey tolerances, it may not make any adjustments. If someone has set it for real tight tolerances, it may go crazy for a while.
I don't know who it was that was just on air. This is KF2CZ. That had brought up a point that it takes almost a minute. I've never had that experience. I mean, I've had long tune cycles, but they never exceeded maybe like 8 to 10 seconds maximum.
Yeah, that was N2YYC.
N2YYC, just more information of a G5RV full-size antenna. And as far as the memory, the LDG tuner I have only has one button. And instructions are, you know, a short and a long. So, yeah, if you hit it short, you're supposed to get the memory. But somehow I always end up pulling it down too long.
Okay, that's odd.
Usually the reason for a long tune cycle is because the impedance mismatch is wider than previously thought.
Yeah, I mean, the algorithm can, you know, I mean, if it takes the same small steps, but it has to go to a higher setting than before or than usual, yeah, it takes the small steps, takes a lot of them very slowly. So, yeah, it depends upon the range of correction from its past setting, unless it already has everything in memory, and then it's just, there should be a near instantaneous adjustment of the relays. You know, all of them should kind of click in and click out, and you should be real close to your setting. You know, some antennas are not that sturdy, and the VizWaz kind of shake around with the wind. So maybe that's going on.
Other comments?
Sure. Comment away.
I had to design a control circuit for an antenna tuner for a guy with a mobile. Now, I had no access to the antenna, no permission to modify anything about the antenna whatsoever, but he wanted to be able to auto-tune it. Well, what I had to do to find out the position of the coil that was motorized, I had to go all the way to one end or all the way to the other end until my current went up because of a mechanical jam, and then I could go the other way. It's the only way to determine the position. Now, that would take a tremendously long time to do. Once you've done it once, you can memorize what the setting should be, but if you don't know where you're at, you're dead meat. So this was a recovery when the thing lost, you know, if you took it off the car and lost power, etc. You could do this thing to set it up, drive it all the way to one end, drive it all the way to the other end to determine where it was. Either it's the low end of the coil or the high end of the coil. And that could take a very long time. Now, I don't know about this other antenna tuner, et cetera, the antenna, but if it's never been to a frequency and if it doesn't know where it is, it has to figure it out somehow and then go, it could go, let's say it's got to go from minimum L to maximum L, et cetera, the greatest distance to search, and maximum C, minimum C, et cetera. So it could take a very long time. Whether 1 minute is reasonable, I can't say it. I don't familiar with that in particular antenna tuner. AF2B.
Yeah, I could understand you talking about a screwdriver antenna, but in this case, it's a number, a well-known number of discrete relay-driven components. So you kind of always know where the reference is. We had that same kind of a problem figuring out a loop antenna that kind of is remotely controllable, but I don't think it had a particular reference point. So you had to rediscover the reference point. But with these types of antenna tuners, it shouldn't be a relative reference point. It's an absolute relay configuration.
Yes, that's correct. But if it's never been to, let's say it only uses relays to either switch in or switch out inductance, switch in or switch out capacitance. The design could be such that its first attempt is to move L greater. And if it sees the SWR going up, it goes the other direction. If it sees it going down, fine. And then it could be to move the capacitor and back and rocker back and forth. It could be a rotten algorithm and could take more. Again, I don't know if 1 minute is acceptable, but I can see where that could be a function of the design of the darn thing.
Yeah, I agree totally. It may be a terrible algorithm. My problem is the way Howard explained it. It sounds like his memory in his tuner isn't working, because it's not like he's going to a new frequency the way that he described it. He's going to a particular frequency on the band, and when he gets there, it's taking a much longer time. So difficult to say. Could be the algorithm. Could be that the memory is kind of not really engaging the way it's supposed to. Who knows?
Oh, yeah. If he's going where he's been already, it shouldn't take that at all.
Yeah, I mean, it should be near instantaneous when you're talking about relays. With my Palstar, it can take a little bit longer because, as I mentioned, it's using servos, and it's there's only a certain speed for servos. So if rotating the coil, you got to wait for the coil to rotate as many times as it has to. But with relays, they kind of snap too.
Oh, yeah. Well, you want to see me do my manual tuner, the ultimate transmatch. When I go from 160 to 10, forget about it. I'm cranking forever on the roller inductor.
Yeah, I have a manual Palstar next to my auto Palstar. I don't know. I'm still fascinated by the damn thing. I could understand where it could get incredibly tedious.
One other thing.
Yep.
I think Rich mentioned that he has an NSAID half wave, so that's kind of like, it depends on how long it is, because an NSAID half wave antenna is resonant at a frequency that corresponds to half its total length. So it's typically calculated for a band such as like 40 or 80 meters, and that might be the sweet spots of the fundamental and then the harmonic.
Yeah, that's how NFED half waves work.
Mine is 66 feet long, which is 40 meters.
Okay. That's the lowest SWR, probably like mid-band.
Um, It skews a little bit towards the lower end.
Okay. Well, you know, at least you're res- I mean, I know a couple of people that have, you know, not NFED, but they, you know, they have just regular, I don't know what they have. They have, you know, beams and stuff like that. But, you know, they have it, so they just change it with a switch, and they're resonant on either, you know, let's say 80 or 40 meters, or what could be 20, 40, and 80. It depends on how they have it set up.
I have a little problem because I had to get a guy to climb the tree, and he didn't speak English, and I don't know how he tied it up to the tree. So there might be a little bit of an effect of the way he tied it to the tree. Okay, guys,
it's working
fine. I also use an NFED half-wave portable to do POTA, and I love those antennas. They work great.
They'll never stop.
So, okay, guys, it's been fun. We must do this again real soon, like next week. I thank everyone who participated tonight. It was an interesting experience, and Rich, once again, I wish you luck, and we'll see how everything works out for you. You know, you come back next week, and if anything new develops or you have any other questions next week. Thanks to everyone who participated, but it's 10:24, and certainly a good time for full WS2N with the SpaceNet report.
Okay, it's GSWS2N, and, okay, very good, Roy. Playing around with my wireless mouse here.
Thanks, Roy.
Actually, charge it. charge lasts so long, probably about a year since I charged it. Anyway, it was a launcher, about a month and a half ago, 2 months ago. It was a combination of NASA and the Indian Space Program. And they sent a satellite up around 400 plus miles into orbit, polar orbit. And its name of it is NISAR, N-I-S-A-R, N for NASA, and I-S-A-R is for the Indian Space Agency. And they collaborated on this. India launched a rocket, NASA and India both constructed the satellite. And the reason I bring it up is it has an antenna, 39 feet in diameter, is the reflector. And then they work on the S-band and the L-band. And you know, the first preliminary pictures are in. You know, it's a science mission. It's a synthetic aperture radar. So as it goes over the Earth, it's sending the signals down, bouncing them off the surface, whether it's water or trees or ground, it can tell the difference. And then the signal comes back up to the receiver. And they get the results, and I saw a couple of pictures. It's amazing. It's amazing that it's a radar picture. You think it was an actual photograph, but it's not. They did a test over South Dakota, an area, and they're very happy with the results. And it's not even functional yet. I mean, it's not in what they call the science mode yet. The idea is to look at, you know, the dry surfaces, the water, through the ice. You're going to get detailed pictures coming back from this. And then they scan the whole planet every 6 days. And like I said, you know, it's the L band and the S band. You know, L band being between 1 and 2 gigahertz, and S between 2 and 4 gigahertz. I was wondering if they're going to interfere with, you know, amateur radio. You know, where between the one, was the 1.24 and the 1300. You know, 1.3 gigahertz. Band. But anyway, it's doing well, and we'll see. We'll see how this thing goes. You know, it's good to see some kind of a science satellite being launched, because right now NASA is cutting back on pretty much everything to do with science. They are all leaving the manned space program intact, but the other programs are slowly being cut or you know, really shortened as far as what they want to do. There's a couple of spacecraft that we talk about all the time, Voyager. They are going to keep that going. And I think they want to cancel New Horizon. That's the one that went out to Pluto and beyond. I hope they don't do that. You know, it's completely functional. These things, you know, of course, you know, billions of dollars to put up there. To actually put another one up in the future, you know, it would not only would be expensive, but you know, it takes years to get to where they are. You know, Voyagers were launched in what, 1970, I think, 77. Anyway, any comments on this particular mission or any other space questions for now?
Hi, Rich. It's Brian, KF2ZZ. What was the mission about?
This particular one was, what is it about? It's a science mission. The idea is to, you know, look down at the Earth and get all the information on, you know, on the surface of the Earth. They go over the mountains, and they can tell the how high, you know, how high a mountain is. And maybe next week it might be shorter. They could look at the land and see if it's shifted even a little bit. It might give them a clue on earthquakes or, you know, all the science stuff. The information that's being shared between India and the United States. But I think it's pretty much open source. Back to you, Brian.
Okay. No, it sounds interesting. I'm still listening. Go on.
Yeah, that's a heavy lift rocket. India has primarily two rockets that they use. The one that goes into geosynchronous orbit, and another one that goes into polar orbit, and you know, so they have the capability of heavy lift vehicles. In fact, they're working on a manned flight. They expect within a couple of years to send a crew up and just into orbit, and then bring them back. You know, they have a crew vehicle that's been developed and already tested. So they're moving along. And so, you know, you have a lot of different countries that are involved. India has successfully launched rocket, landed on the moon successfully. They've sent spacecraft to Mars. So, you know, and the United States is really starting to fall behind. So, you know, the last thing you need is for something like that to happen. China is starting to catch up. And the goal for the United States, of course, is to land somebody, a person, on the moon, and where right now I don't want to get political, but that there are the funds that are being cut are not going to help the space program in general, where China is pouring a ton of money into their space program. So, you know, I know we've been there first. We've landed six successful landings on the moon with people. Yeah, but it's like another space race going on now. You know, that was between Russia and the United States. Now it's, again, between China and the United States. Anyway, we'll see. A couple of other topics I wanted to cover. As I lose my voice here. Starship number 11 by SpaceX will be launching tomorrow. And this I want to see. Starship Monday, yeah, that's right. Okay, I just wanted to double check. Monday evening, I think it's 7:30 or 7:15, something like that. You can go to their website and see if it makes it. And this is their large rocket. The Starship is 400 feet tall, close to it. And it's got 33 engines. They've launched this monster 10 previous times. And I think around 6 or 7 of them actually have blown up. They've made a couple of successful flights. The last one was number 10. And that worked out okay. The plan still has not been to go to orbit. Number 10 launched. The booster was successful. They brought the booster down vertically into the Gulf of Mexico. The second stage, which is actually the Starship, flew to suborbital flight, which means it went all the way to the Indian Ocean. And that came down vertically. They had a buoy out there in the ocean, so they knew exactly where it was going to theoretically land, and that came down vertically. And they ran some tests during the flight. They wanted to see if they could relight an engine. They did that. That's very important. That's for the future. They need to be able to relight engines in space. And they had duplicated launching satellites. They were dummy satellites, so they launched a few of them. Now, this flight, number 11, I don't really get. I mean, it's pretty much duplicating flight number 10. Maybe they feel like they got lucky last time and they just want to double check. I just don't understand a reason why they're doing this again without taking the next step and putting the rocket ship into orbit, which would be a big plus. One of the things that the yard is going to do different is reuse a booster. The booster that went up previously, they're going to take the same booster, minus a few engines. They're going to add a couple of new engines. And they just want to show that they have either the ability to reuse these things, or they're just trying to cut back on a cost, you know. And they're not going to bring this stage back for reuse. Again, this one's going to go into the Gulf of Mexico, like last time. So it looks like a do-over to me. So, unless I'm missing something. Any comments?
Oh, pretty interesting stuff. What's going on in terms of the, my God, what's the mission that they want to launch from NASA? Artemis?
Yeah, that's going ahead. You know, it's a strange setup the way they're involved with SpaceX for trying to get to the moon. But you're right, Artemis is the rocket, well, the rocket system that will launch the crew of four to the moon. And that will be launched on the Space Launch System. And that's coming together. They're stacking it, you know, as we speak. You know, they have the core stage in. They have the, essentially, the second stage in. I think all they need to do is get the crew vehicle Orion bolted up. And on top of that, they put the launch abort system, which is, you know, it's actually a large rocket, you know, just in case they need to abort. To give you an idea, that launch abort system is more powerful than the first Red Star rocket that launched Shepard into space on a 15-minute suborbital flight, you know, first American to actually go into space. Just the launch abort system, you know, to pull the whole spacecraft away from the booster in case there was an emergency, is much more powerful than the old Redstone rocket. So, yeah, I mean, it will deliver 8.5 million pounds of thrust from the first stage compared to 7.5 million pounds of thrust that the old Saturn V had to launch people to the moon. And you ask how it's going. They have plans on sending four people around the moon and back in as early as April. Now they're talking about maybe March, but I'm not seeing that. They might shoot for March, but there's always delays, so I'm going to guess April. And that will not land on the moon. That will be putting somebody around the moon and then back, you know, four people. And they're going to test out the crew vehicle, the Orion spacecraft. But the reason it's a strange deal with SpaceX was chosen years ago to be the rocket that would land people actually on the moon, the human landing system, HLS they call it. What they plan on doing is having a Starship, one of these things that keep blowing up. They get their act together and stop doing that. And if they can get to the point where they could send one of these things to the moon, it would be orbiting the moon, and it would be waiting for an Orion spacecraft to get there, launched by the NASA space launch system that I just talked about. Once they dock around the moon, docking, you know, they'll exchange a crew. There's four people in the Orion. Two will get into the Starship. The Starship will go down to land vertically. It will spend 1 week on the moon. When they're done, pack up and launch the whole Starship back into lunar orbit to, again, dock with the Orion spacecraft. And from there, Orion would be sent back to Earth. That is what happens to the Starship. Well, they're going to leave it there and then hopefully be able to reuse it on the next flight. Now, the reason this whole setup is really weird and crazy is because to get that Starship, that first Starship, to the moon, it's going to require, sometimes, some people are guessing, 20 to 40 flights of big Starships filled with fuel. Here's what they want to do. They want to put a Starship into orbit, and, you know, it'll have fuel in it, but it'll pretty much we run out of fuel. It takes a lot of fuel to put one into orbit. And now they need to fill it to the top before they launch a spacecraft to the moon. They will have to send up maybe 30 of these starship to dock with this fueling starship that's in orbit around the Earth and constantly refuel. And the reason they have to keep doing this is because the cryogenic fuels, they evaporate over time. They're constantly evaporating. You can't just, like, close it off. It's all cryogenically cool. If it starts to warm up, you close all the valves, the pressure will, you know, keep going all the way up to thousands of pounds per square inch and blow the vehicle apart. So it's constantly off-gassing. So the off-gassing constantly has to be refilled. You know, if you delay for any reason, having a refueling vehicle go up, more and more fuel will off-gas, which means, well, instead of, you know, 20 starships to refuel, oh, now we need 21, maybe 22, depending on, you know, when they actually are ready. Finally, when they are ready, they're going to launch this thing all the way to the moon. I still haven't figured out all the reading I did. Once this is around the moon, again, that's still going to be off-gassing. Are they going to have to send other starships to the moon to dock with that existing starship to keep that thing refueled? It's a problem for Elon Musk to think this is all going to happen by 2027. You know? I don't think so. I mean, I wish he could, you know. I'm looking probably, you know, 5 years down the road, which is going to be a problem because that's probably around the time China would like to send somebody and land their taconaut, that's what they call them, not astronauts, taconaut onto the lunar surface. So, I mean, that's pretty much where we're Artemis stands. It's part of this whole SpaceX deal. Originally, probably going to time out. Originally, what happened was there was no NASA administrator back in 2021, the beginning of 2021. And what happened was an arrangement went through. They had an acting administrator, and oh yeah, this is going to be a good idea. We're going to have SpaceX be the only provider to help NASA with the human landing system. You know, dropping down from lunar orbit to the moon and back up to be docking with the Orion spacecraft. You know, and all the NASA engineers for countless decades, they believe in redundancy. You know, there was two voyages. There were two Pioneer spacecraft. There were half a dozen or more lunar landers, Surveyor that landed on the moon. They had four or five of them years ago. All these different missions, lunar orbiter missions, you know. Everything was, you know, two or three or four more. All of a sudden, they got the bright idea. One is good enough. And thankfully, what happened was another year, a couple of years went by, and Bill Nelson had become the NASA administrator, approved by the Senate. And when he was in there, they said, you know, we need a plan B in case SpaceX doesn't work out. Let's do what we normally do, redundancy. So they got a hold of Blue Origin, owned by Jeff Bezos, another rich guy. And they said, you know, you're developing a lander to land on the moon. You know, let's give you a contract in case SpaceX doesn't work out, or we could use both. Which they did. So for the last who knows how many years, they've been building the lunar lander over at Blue Origin. So they do now have a plan B. And I'm kind of starting to think, well, if SpaceX can't do this deal with 20 or 30 launches for refueling and this whole complicated scheme, at least we now have Blue Origin, one big massive vehicle that will land on the moon. I mean, this thing's 30 feet tall. You know, much, much taller than the limb that, you know, that they sent. And it's about, I think it's around 12 or 14 feet in diameter. Anyway, they do have a cargo version of this that should be launched by the end of this year, maybe the beginning of next year. But right now the plan is to land the cargo version of this. They call it MK. MK-1 is the cargo version. MK-2 is the people version. So hopefully that will work out. If they could land that cargo spacecraft down on the moon, I think that would be a big plus. And even if SpaceX doesn't work out, you know, maybe we could do it with a crew on MK-1 by Blue Origin. Any comments?
I think you explained everything very well. You know, as you were explaining, I was kind of thinking about, you know, from the Apollo missions to the anticipated Artemis mission. I'm saying to myself, where is the real difference? I don't see a difference. I don't see anything. I don't see it, you know, from a cost standpoint or what we're going to learn from it. It just seems like a repeat of Apollo. Am I wrong?
No, you're not wrong. I mean, it's an Apollo spacecraft on steroids, you know? Instead of sending three people to the moon, they'll be sending four people to the moon. When Apollo was, going full blast, they got up to Apollo 17. Mission or two before that, I think it was around Apollo 13 or 14. NASA didn't get any more contracts. They had plans of launching Apollo missions all the way up to 21. And they were designed similar to what they had. They landed six of these vehicles on the moon. And they would have landed in other different locations, and they would have tested the surface and done a lot more science than what they were doing. You know, but no real plans of staying. I mean, they thought maybe if they can get to flight number 21, that maybe other contracts would be, you know, put out where they could send more rockets to the moon and maybe someday set up a base there and all. But, of course, that never happened. You know, money dried up. This time they plan on staying. As the missions, roughly one a year, it will be the way it starts off. As they go up, they plan on staying there longer and longer. There's a Gateway space station that's planned. Looks like they're going to cancel it now. Who knows? Maybe you get another different administration in there. Maybe they'll bring it back. But they were building hardware. You know, they're going to have a space station in lunar orbit. The idea is to stay, and then that's why they're picking the South Pole. Let me drop it. This is WS2N. Because with the South Pole, they could eventually mine the ice that they know is down in these craters and use that ice for, you know, breaking down the water. I'm sure you'd be able to eventually drink it. You could separate it, now you have hydrogen and oxygen. Now you have hydrogen for fuel if you want, and the oxygen you could build. What do you call what cells? Anyway, you could. I'm trying to think of the name. I'll think of it. Getting late. You make hydrogen and oxygen. And you put that across a membrane, and it's called a fuel cell. There we go. You can make fuel cells with that hydrogen and oxygen that you get from the ice, which becomes water. And of course, you can eventually take the oxygen and breathe it. So that's the reason they're heading to the South Pole. It's also a lot more light down there, so you can set up solar panels. And eventually create a base down there. So that's the long-term plan. And China has the same idea. They plan on going to the South Pole as well. So we get there, we'll have neighbors. Any comments?
Well, I think that probably a better idea from the start was to not go ahead with this Artemis program, because I don't think it serves any purpose except for political reasons to be there first again before everyone starts catching up and fakes a claim on the moon. Now, this is KFQZZ Station ID, but that's just my opinion. My theory, and I could be wrong on this, and probably am, is that I would have kept the space shuttles in service and have them modified to go from the, and I don't even know if this is possible because there's radiation and everything else, but I don't know. This is just conjecture, to go from the ISS to lunar orbit. And then from lunar orbit, go ahead and construct a lunar orbiting space station, okay, called LOSS, L-O-S-S, Lunar Orbiting Space Station. And then they would be able to stay for a bit and then eventually go ahead and build something to land on the moon, come back up to the space station, and then go back to Earth, or go back to the ISS, and probably refuel there by having SpaceX, bring up fuel at a much lower cost. But again, this is just my idea, and that's the way you would go about colonizing the moon because of all the space in the cargo bay of the space shuttles.
Okay, and they're doing everything that you just said. I mean, that was the plan as of a year ago. The Gateway space station, you put that into the computer, put that on the Wikipedia, and you're going to see everything that the plans of what they planned on doing, all the different modules that are being built now, or I guess they're going to put them in mothballs. But they had equipment. They had a plan. They would have had a space station in lunar orbit, and exactly what you said, we were going to go up, with this Artemis program. The Orion spacecraft would have docked with the space station, could have hung out there for a while, and then attached to that space station would be the lunar landing, the human landing system, by two people. Like I said earlier, SpaceX with Starship and this MK-2 crew landing vehicle by Blue Origin. So you could have gone either one down to the moon and back up. And they would have done this over and over again. But since funds are drying up, I think that idea for now is being
put on the back burner. The shuttle itself, to try to get that anywhere higher than, I think, 500 miles is tough. I think Hubble is around 340 miles or something. And they dock with that on a regular basis. And I think that was pretty much the limit of a space shuttle with the rockets that launched it. You know, don't forget they had a gigantic tank similar to a space launch system. Big old orange tank filled with liquid hydrogen and oxygen. Same setup that the space launch system has today. Also, they ran solid booster rockets. Each one had 3 million pounds of thrust, one on the port, one on the starboard side. Space launch system, exactly the same thing, except bigger, taller. Instead of four segments bolted together, there's one even taller. It's five segments to launch the space launch system because it's bigger. And the reason it's bigger is you need to put all this type of things, spacecraft and space stations and all the things you're going to need for the moon. You need something bigger than what they had for Apollo with the Saturn V rocket. So, space shuttle, too big, too heavy. I think it was 200,000 pounds. And best they could do was, you know, a few hundred miles above the Earth. Never mind geosynchronous satellite. Geosynchronous is 23,000 miles above. Can't go there. And you certainly can't go to a quarter of a million, 250,000 miles away to the moon with the shuttle. Anyway, back to you.
Well, what's interesting about it, Paul, is that they could have built a smaller space station, and maybe they could have went ahead and just remote control and just flew that for a lunar insertion, put it around the moon, and then that would have been a lot easier to do, being it was right by the ISS and Earth orbit. So that was just another thought I had.
Okay. And that was the plan. They were going to put it into a rectilinear orbit, which would have been, you go very close to the moon, maybe 1,000 miles away, and then your aperture, your high point, you go all the way to 11,000 miles away. You know, this 10-to-1 ratio. And that was the plan to do that. The reason they were choosing that orbit is because you don't need, or very little, very, you really don't need any fuel to keep it in that orbit. If you go into an orbit closer to the moon, there's something called mass cons on the moon, which is mass concentrations of mass, which kind of change the orbit a little bit on anything that's going around the moon. And you don't want to do that with a manned space program, space station. So they found the best way to do it. In fact, there's a satellite now called Capstone, built and flew by a rocket lab in that particular orbit right now. It was a test to see how the Gateway space station was going to do. And that thing is operating perfectly right now. It was a small satellite launched by Rocket Lab on the Electron rocket. And, everything was going fine until they decided to cut back on everything to do with government, I guess, including NASA. So we'll see. I'm not going to give up. Times change. Administrations change. And next thing you know, they'll be funding something. I mean, they've gone through this already, Bush administration got in, they cut certain programs. They kept others. They thought they were going to have this other lunar landing system. That